طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس.
Good morning, everyone. And welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. In a rather astonishing decision, the State Ethics Commission has summarily rejected Massachusetts Peace Action's complaint regarding the 9 state senators who accepted the December 2015 trip to Israel, organized and paid for by the Jewish Community Relations Council of Boston, the JCRC. The basis for the Massachusetts Peace Action, fondly known as MAPA, that complaint is that the senators violated the Massachusetts Conflict of Interest Law in accepting a trip worth over $4,000 apiece at the same time the JCRC had anti-BDS legislation pending before the legislature. MAPA anticipated that the Ethics Commission might claim that the trip qualified for the exemption created by the Ethics Commission for travel that serves a, quote, legitimate public purpose, unquote. Although the complaint set forth a number of reasons why the trip didn't, in fact, qualify. This, of course, is not what the Ethics Commission said, however. The Ethics Commission instead argued that no action was necessary in response to MAPA's complaint because the senators had filed the required paperwork, which included their determination that the travel served a legitimate public purpose. In other words, the JCRC trip didn't violate the conflict of interest law because the senators said it didn't. Is it not astonishing that the Ethics Commission doesn't care whether a particular legislative trip paid for by a lobbying organization actually serves a legitimate public purpose, but only whether the recipient legislatures say it does? If legislators in a conflict of interest situation can be trusted to determine whether they qualify for an exemption, why bother with a conflict of interest law in the first place? A sworn statement by each legislator that his or her legislative judgment will not be influenced by gifts in any amount seems to suffice. Most disappointing, the Ethics Commission made no response to MAPA's legal argument that the travel exemption itself violates the conflict of interest law. The Ethics Commission's travel exemption seemingly permits travel that serves a public purpose, even if that travel also presents a genuine risk of a conflict of interest. However, the conflict of interest law limits exemptions to, quote, situations that do not present a genuine risk of a conflict or the appearance of a conflict of interest, unquote. If payment of a Senate trip to Israel paid for by a lobbying group which takes place while there is relevant legislation pending before that body does not at least have the appearance of a conflict of interest, then just what does appearance of conflict of interest mean to our Ethics Commission? It means that the Ethics Commission is a joke. But I guess we already knew that. Okay, moving on. This week we feature the courageous, indefatigable Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, who defines the term speaking truth to power. Gideon Levy writes for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz and is a frequent speaker sounding the Palestinian narrative not only in the heart of Israel, but throughout the world. We feature him on This Week in Palestine whenever we can. This week's presentation was given at Brandeis University. Here is Israeli journalist Gideon Levy.
I'm very happy to be here today. Unfortunately, it seems that it's quite a sympathetic audience. In New York, we faced some disturbances, and it challenged us, I must say. I'm now 9 days on the road, and we had some very good opportunities. And in those 10 days, things in Israel deteriorated so much that people told me that you will not recognize Israel that you left just 10 days ago. Things are really getting out of control, and we'll try to get to it. But let's speak first of all about the core issues in my view. Many times you are being told that the conflict in the Middle East is a very complicated conflict, and one cannot describe it in black and white. So I would like to suggest to you today that it is a very simple conflict, a real estate conflict, with very clear black and white, with very clear justice and injustice. And one might even ask if it is a conflict at all. Because when France occupied Algeria, nobody spoke about the French-Algerian conflict. There was a French occupation in Algeria, and when this French occupation in Algeria came to its end, the conflict was over. Not complicated, not nothing. Very, very simple. Black and white it was. When it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian, whatever we call it, those who claim that it is a complicated conflict mean to say that this conflict cannot be solved, that this conflict has too many sides, but by the end of the day, it's all about justice, relative justice, by the way, not total justice, because total justice will never be achieved. Relative justice, very relative justice. And above all, and that's the core word, above all about equality. And as long as Israelis will not perceive the Palestinians as equal human beings, which they don't, and I'll elaborate about this, as long as they don't perceive them as equal human beings, nothing will be solved. And once they will perceive them as equal human beings, everything will seem totally different. I don't want to say that everything will be very simple to be solved after all those years of hatred, of fears. Surely not. But it will seem totally different. For many years, I'm asking myself, how come that the Israeli occupation lasts for so many years when the Israeli society lives with it? With so much peace, with so little doubt, with so little moral questions, with such self-content and convenience that such confidence that we are not only right, we are the only one to be right. With this confidence that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, is the most moral army in the world. Many times I try to suggest to the Israelis, maybe the IDF is the second moral army in the world. You know, by the end of the day, an army which killed 500 women and 500 children last summer in Gaza, maybe it's not directly connected to morality. Or maybe it is really the second moral army in the world, and the army of Luxembourg. Let's put this army, if it exists at all. Do you have an army? Do you have an army? No army, sorry. Not Luxembourg, Liechtenstein. The army of Liechtenstein is the most moral army in the world. And Israelis, rightly so, will be deeply offended. How can you dare to put a question mark at all about the morality of the in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. This deep conviction that everything is right, the occupation is right, brings you to ask yourself, how is it possible for so many years? And here I want to suggest a few possible answers which rely on very deep-rooted beliefs and values in Israeli society, which enable us Israelis for so many years to maintain this occupation. And as the famous advertisement, Israeli advertisement for brass goes, to go with and to feel without. We go with the occupation and we feel almost totally without it. The first very deep-rooted belief, in my view, which is almost general in Israel, even if it's not outspoken, is the belief that we are the chosen people. Religious and secularists will share this view. They will not phrase it in the same way. The religious will talk more about the God who chose us to be the chosen people. Others will just say that we are the best, we know the best, we are always the best, and nobody will tell us what to do. This very deep-rooted value enables us Israelis to believe that there are certain things that are allowed to us and are forbidden to the rest of the world, because we are different, because we are the chosen people. Let's take, for example, a small example, the international law. Extremely important, vital. This international law, which, by the way, was formulated after World War II and after what happened in World War II. It's extremely important. It applies to all the countries in the world. Not only Israel, because we are a special case. So international law, which defines very clearly what are crimes of war, what is the meaning of occupation, what is the meaning of settlement, it doesn't apply to Israel. Why? Because that's the first set of values. The second very deep-rooted value is the fact that we, the Jewish people, and we, the Israelis, are first of all the biggest victim in history, but what is more important to say, we are the only victim in history, or at least the only victim in history that should be taken seriously as a victim. Because even the Armenians are not suiting enough to carry the title of being a big victim of history. This enables us to think that if we are the biggest victims in history, again, it gives us special rights and special privileges because we are victims. The late Golda Meir, Israeli Prime Minister, phrased it in the best way. She said it directly. She always said direct things. She said, after the Holocaust, the Jews have the right to do whatever they want. As simple as that. That's the lesson. And that's the lesson that, in one way or the other, we are trying to teach the younger generations in Israel when we send all of them, with tens of thousands, to Auschwitz, to those studying missions. That's basically the message that they get there. We are the victims, we are the only victims, and after the Holocaust we have the right to do whatever we want, and our only way to live will be on our sword, on our military power, and all the rest is quite minor. Because one should remember that there were more brutal occupations in history, and there were even longer occupations in history than the Israeli one. But I cannot recall one example in which the occupier presented himself as the victim. This occupation was forced upon us. We never wanted those territories. We never want to rule the Palestinians. We don't want it, but it was imposed on us like an earthquake, like a catastrophe, like a force majeure. And we are the victims. And again, if to quote another lovely, lovely, lovely quotation from the late Golda Meir, I like to quote her here because you Americans exported her to us. She was born in Milwaukee. She was brought up in Milwaukee. She said another very, very interesting sentence, which is very typical. She said once that we will never forgive the Palestinians for forcing us to kill their children. So we are the victims. We kill their children, but we are obviously the victims. That's the subtext. So this feeling, very deep feeling of being the victims, with everything that goes around it, paranoia of victims, fears of victims, present ourselves for years as the David against this Goliath, as the weak one who is always in existential danger. When you speak about security, it's always about the security of the Israelis. You have never heard anybody talk about the security of the Palestinians, because we are the victims. This enables us also to live in peace with the occupation, because victims can occupy, because they were victims. But that's not enough. And to this one should add another very deep-rooted belief in Israeli society. If you stretch under the skin of almost every Israeli, you will find out that Israelis perceive, I'll be very careful here, perceive the Palestinians not exactly as equal human beings like them. I once wrote that we treat the Palestinians like animals, and I got so many protest letters from animal rights organizations who rightly claim that even animals should have their own rights. But it's very clear that most of the Israelis don't perceive the Palestinians as equal human beings, and then question of human rights are less relevant because we deal with something which is not exactly like us. They were born to kill, they are cruel, they are bloodthirsty, they are almost all of them are terrorists. The only thing they want is to throw us Israelis to the ocean. That's the only goal in their lives. And this enables, again, to live in peace with an occupation and not to feel any moral doubts. So these three sets of beliefs, which are, again, I say, so deep-rooted, enable Israelis not to really be aware to what is being done on their behalf. For this, we have also very successful agencies which help us to keep, to maintain those beliefs, and above all, the Israeli media, which is a free media. Most of it is commercial, privately owned, without not too much ideology, but wants to please the Israelis, don't want to bother the Israelis, wants to sell newspapers, to have high rating, and not to tell the full story, which most of the Israelis don't want to know. And here we get Israeli public agenda that anyone who comes from abroad can't believe how absent is the occupation in the public discourse in Israel. It doesn't exist at all. I mean, I remember years in which the joke was that two Israelis share three views. Today's three Israelis hardly share one view. Last elections, the last campaign, nobody mentioned the occupation, not from right, not from left, nothing. As if it doesn't exist, this huge elephant in our room, and no one sees this elephant. And we think that if we don't talk about this elephant, if we don't direct our eyes at this elephant, the elephant is not in the room. But the elephant is in the room, and will never leave this room. And so, Israelis train themselves to live in peace with the occupation. But then there is another problem. The world. The world is very clear about the Israeli occupation, at least in a declarative level. I can't recall one issue, which the entire world is united about, like the lack of legitimacy of the Israeli occupation. No country, including even Micronesia, Israel's second ally, even Micronesia does not recognize the Israeli occupation, even not 1 meter of this occupation, and so does even the United States, and we'll get to the United States soon. So we have a problem. The world is very clear about it. So this problem was also solved. The world is anyhow against Israel. Most of the world is anti-Semitic, let's face it. Yeah. Any criticism on Israel is anti-Semitism. And by this, again, we released ourselves of any responsibility because it's the world's blame, not ours. The fact that the world hugged Israel after Oslo, rightly so, wrongly so, hugged Oslo, hugged Israel, is forgotten. Because then one can ask, where was all this anti-Semitism in the 90s, where really the world was hugging Israel, when there was really a hope for ending the occupation? No. So there is this protective shield in which Israelis believe that doesn't matter what the world says because the world is anti-Semitic and one shouldn't listen to the world. And here we face this occupation, which creates a very interesting situation in Israel. I think it's the only country in the world which possesses three regimes. Not one, not two, three regimes. In the front, we have this liberal democracy for its Jewish citizens, quite a liberal democracy which enables almost full freedom of speech, freedom of movement, all the basic values, with a lot of cracks, recently even more so. Nothing should be taken for granted. There are really big dangers to Israeli democracy for its Jewish citizens, with anti-democratic legislations in the recent years, really anti-democratic legislations, but still one can claim that this is a democracy. Then comes the second regime in Israel, and this is the regime toward its Palestinian citizens. 20% of the population of Israel are what we like to call Israeli Arabs, Palestinians who live in Israel, in sovereign Israel, and have full civil rights. They have passports, they vote to the parliament, they can be elected to the parliament, they are represented in the parliament. They gain a formal democracy with very, very deep discrimination in any possible field, but still they are equal citizens on the formal level. So this is the second regime, a regime of discrimination toward the Palestinian citizenship. And then comes obviously the third regime of Israel, and this is a regime that Israel is having in the occupied territories, in the West Bank, and in a different way on Gaza. A regime that is by far today one of the most brutal tyrannies on earth. There are very, very few more cruel or more brutal totalitarian regimes than the totalitarian regime of Israel in the occupied territories. A regime which cannot be defined but as an apartheid regime, when two peoples share one piece of land and one people gains all the rights in the world and the other people gain no right in the world. It looks like apartheid, it walks like apartheid, and it is apartheid. And that's the third regime of Israel, the apartheid in its dark backyard. Now, some of you might know by now that there is nothing like being half pregnant. It doesn't work. Many times maybe we wish it would have worked, it doesn't work. Either you are pregnant or you are not. Same applies about democracy. There is nothing like half democratic. Either you are a democracy or you are not. And you can't be a democracy or claim to be the only democracy in the Middle East when in your backyard you possess one of the most brutal tyrannies on earth today. It doesn't go together. And therefore, the Israeli claim that it is a democracy is a very problematic claim, as long as this is going on in its backyard. And I must remind you here that Israel exists many, many, many more years with the occupation rather than without it. So nobody can claim anymore that we are dealing with a temporary phenomenon. The occupation is part and parcel of Israel. So We are facing this not very promising picture in which the Israelis are living in peace with the occupation. The occupation is getting just stronger and deeper. More and more settlements are built, as you know. We are facing now between 600,000 to 700,000 settlers in the West Bank, with no intention to leave, with no Israeli serious politician who have the slightest intention to put an end to it. And then comes the question, how do we continue from here? Where is some kind of source of hope? So here I must say, again, you can take my word, you can obviously not take it, but I think I know the Israeli society quite well after so many years of living there. Don't have any expectations for change from within the Israeli society. It will not come. Life in Israel is too good. Brainwash machine is too effective. I don't see it happening or coming from within, a change coming from within the Israeli society. No politicians who suggest any kind of real change, no alternative. There are some devoted groups and individuals which are really remarkable, and don't take me wrong, they really are adorable. But they are very small in numbers, and they are totally delegitimized by the Israeli media and the Israeli society. And therefore their influence is almost nothing. I say it with a lot of frustration, but it's a matter of fact. Organizations like Breaking the Silence and B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights and Anarchists Against the Fence and Ta'ayush and Mahzom Watch and many others and individuals who go and demonstrate every week in Bilin, in Alin, in Evisaler, in many places. Remarkable people in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. But their influence is limited, if not less than this. And I think that as long as this set of conditions will continue, no change will come from the Israeli society. There's no incentive for a change. Why? Why would a Tel Avivian who is now so troubled about his next vacation or next jeep be troubled by those settlers and the occupied territories, a place where he had never visited, and hears about it so little and knows about it so little? Why should he bother about this at all? Who cares? You know, those nudniks with the kibbush, with the occupation again, again. How many times can we hear about the occupation? Really, give us a break. And I don't see, and obviously the collaboration of the Israeli media, which is by far the biggest collaborator, is the Israeli occupation. I don't see any chance for change from within the Israeli society. And then the question is, what are we supposed to do? Those who care, those who don't want to live with this forever, or those who understand that the status quo will not last forever? Because there is not one single example in human history in which any empire lived on its sword forever. Doesn't exist. And here I stand here and I suggest that the only hope for people like me, at least, is the international community. Now, in the international community, there are two levels. This is the level of the civil societies, of the public opinions, and there is the level of the governments. With the governments, we are doing very badly. And above all, unfortunately, with yours, which could have become so easily a game changer. I truly believe that the day there will be an American president who will really want to put an end to the occupation will come to its end within months. Within months. But this day never came. And there was, until today, not one single American president who really wanted to put an end to the occupation. Because Israel is as depending as never before on the United States. But this doesn't happen. Many times, you know, when one looks at the relations between Israel and the United States, one can ask himself, who is exactly the superpower between the two? And who is in the pocket of whom? And who flatters to whom? And who tries to please whom? And who tries to apologize all the time in front of whom? We had now the agreement with Iran. President Obama was generous enough to offer Israel compensation for the agreement. Compensation for what? Israel is the biggest actor who gets the best out of this agreement. The best out of this agreement. Why compensation? But okay, generosity of presidents is always welcome in Israel. But not in this case. Because Mr. Netanyahu announced the American administration that he is not ready yet to discuss the compensation. Not yet. Time will come, but not yet. And the American administration is swallowing it and say nothing. An Israeli ambassador is sitting in Washington, knocking on the door of almost each congressman and senator, trying to recruit legislators against the administration. And this is accepted. I can't think about one single state that would have dared to behave like this. I can't think about the Americans. Can you see an American ambassador sitting in Jerusalem, in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament, try to recruit Israeli parliamentarians against the prime minister? But Israeli ambassador can do it, and he was doing it until the agreement with Iran was accepted. And even this was accepted in this country. So we have a problem with governments. Europe, needless to say, is a pale shadow of the United States when it comes to the Middle East. Europe also carries its own complexes, guilt feelings, historical guilt, and the expectation that Europe, or at least part of Europe, on a governmental level, will really change is quite small. But the potential is so big. I'll give you an example. I wanted to write an article in the last war on Gaza that Austrian Airlines can bring peace to the Middle East. You might ask, why Austrian Airlines? I'll tell you very simply, because Austrian Airlines stopped its flights to Israel in the middle of the war for 18 hours maybe. And after Austrian Airlines, there were most of the Western airlines who declared that they don't fly to Israel. I can tell you, 18 hours, Israelis almost got mad, but they survived. If it would have become 18 days, I think Israel would have given up all the entire occupied territories, including Jerusalem. But being more serious, it's very clear to me that civil societies and organizations and individuals can start to make a difference. Because people like me believe that Israeli society needs a wake-up call. And I'll be more harsh than this. Let's be frank, Israelis deserve to be punished for the occupation and for the crimes. And Israelis deserve to be taken accountable for those crimes. And, you know, it's not very easy to be saved by an Israeli who lives in Israel. But if I'll be very sincere with you, that's my very genuine emotion. I think that people who are responsible for crimes should pay for them. I don't think that anyone has any doubts about how criminal is the occupation, how many crimes are being committed on a daily basis, by the way. Crimes of war on a daily basis. On a weekly basis, in very peaceful periods, we can say on a weekly basis. So I think that a wake-up call to the Israeli society and a very clear message that crimes must be brought to justice and criminals must be brought to justice might make a change. It was very effective with apartheid South Africa. It was one of the game changers, as you know. I just want to warn you here that In South Africa, I was told that one of the main effective boycotts was the boycott on sport. With Israel, it will not work so well because Israel is not doing very well in sport. So I'm not sure that boycott on sport will be the real game changer. But I truly believe that it's now for the international community to say its word. Is it acceptable in the 21st century to have an apartheid system anywhere? Is it acceptable in the 21st century to have still a military occupation, one of the last ones on Earth? Is it acceptable to continue to have a colonization of a piece of land, one of the last, if not the last, colonialistic regimes? And if it's not acceptable, what are we doing about it? And the question comes, the next question obviously is the question, what can be the solution? Because it's very nice to say that the status quo is not acceptable, but what can bring real justice to the Middle East? And for many years I was obviously, like maybe most of you, I don't know, I was a great supporter obviously of the two-state solution. I thought this is the easiest way, this is the more practical way, this is the maybe even the more just way to divide this land for two peoples. Each people will have its own state, independent, self-definition, and this can be the solution. I still believe that this is the best solution. There's one slight, very small problem that I think that this train left the station already, and it is nature of trains, unfortunately, so they never come back. I'm not sure they can come back, but they left the station. This train left the station, in my view. I'll be the happiest person on Earth to be convinced that I'm wrong, that the two-state solution is still applicable. I have my doubts because with 700,000 settlers, I don't see any Israeli politician evacuating 700,000 settlers, and I don't see any viable Palestinian state with those 700,000 settlers, or even part of them staying where they are. We know exactly why they went there, or at least most of them went there. They went to prevent any kind of settlement. This was their basic motivation. They went to prevent any possibility for the two-state solution. And I think it's time to admit that they won. This powerful, the most powerful political group in Israeli society, maybe the only group, big, meaningful group, which was really ready to struggle on its cause or causes, won. And with 700,000 people, settlers, I don't see how a two-state solution is still something that is achievable. And again, I must emphasize, anyone who will prove me wrong, I'll be very happy to admit that I was wrong. More and more people understand that the two-state solution is either dead or dying, but it takes some time to change, because this is something that people were fighting for decades now. And to admit that we lost is not something very, very simple. But I think it's time to stop speaking about the two-state solution only because of one reason. Because I think that most of those who continue to talk about the two-state solution are doing so only to gain more time, to deepen the occupation, to build more settlements. And therefore, the discourse, at least the international discourse, I think, should change. And we have to start to talk about equal rights. Because equal rights is something that no one in Israel will be able to refuse and not give an explanation. Why are you against equal rights? Because you are chosen people. I mean, why not equal rights to everybody who lives between the river and the sea? So many Israelis will tell you, horrified, then it's the end of the Jewish state, and the whole dream was a Jewish state. Fine, not that I know what does it mean, a Jewish state. I'm not sure that America is an American state. I've never heard that France is a French state. It's not for me to define a state according to ethnic or religious definitions. But those Israelis who, for them, this is vital to have a Jewish state, without even knowing what does it mean, to them I can very easily say, where have you been until now? Anyone who wants a Jewish state should be for the two-state solution long time ago and do something about it. Because the only way to have a Jewish state is by maintaining a Jewish majority. And Jewish majority can only be in the 67 borders. Any other borders, you don't have a Jewish majority. And then they say it must be Jewish and democratic. The democratic sounds always like a lip service. Because most of the intelligent people understand that there is nothing like Jewish and democratic. Because it's a built-in contradiction. Because if you are Jewish, the translation of it is privileges to one people on the other. This has nothing to do with democracy. This is anti-democracy. If you want a Jewish state, you need, first of all, a Jewish majority. But still, what about the minorities' rights? Why to define it as Jewish or not Jewish? Let it be a democratic state. And you know, if there will be a Jewish majority, they will decide they want a Jewish state, which means, I don't know what, that each of us will have to go with a beard and wear a yarmulke. Okay, but it must be a democratic state before anything else. So in this stage, when the two-state solution is dying or dead, I think that the international community and people like you, who I guess have interest and have knowledge and have this urge to do something, must start to change the discourse and start to talk about equal rights. I know it's a long, long, long way. I know that to speak now about the one democratic state sounds terrible and sounds lunatic, and sounds, especially with the background of what's going on now, with all the hatred and the fear from both sides, by the way, how can you make this work? It sounds really almost impossible. But first of all, one should not judge the future according to the present situation. The whole idea is to change the present. The whole idea is to change the present reality. And not to continue the present. Sure, if we continue the present reality, there is no way that Jews and Palestinians will be able to live together in peace or in democracy or in equality. But the idea is to change this. And anyone who has a better idea is invited always to raise it. I don't see any other way but to start to talk about equal rights, because I don't see any other option. No other option was left. Mainly because of the Israelis. They didn't leave much option for anything else. And therefore, that's the time to start to speak about it, to start to raise it, and to start to push for it. And still, it's not a very optimistic vision, as you can imagine yourself, when people are stabbing each other in the streets of Israel, and lynches are being taken place almost on a daily basis, and people are executed on a daily basis, and people are killed, and so much bloodshed. To speak about equal rights for everyone and one state solution, I just must remind you, before you get so shocked by this, that one state exists now for 48 years. It's not that I come here and suggest something unheard of. It is a one state for 48 years. The only problem is that it's not a democratic state. It is a state with three regimes, as I try to describe. But it is a one state. The Green Line doesn't exist anymore for a long time. It is one entity. And the fate of my friend, my Palestinian friends here, is much more decided in Jerusalem rather than in Ramallah. And when President Abbas wants to move from one town to the other in the West Bank, he needs permission from Israel. So it is one state. Let's not cheat ourselves. And if it is one state, then it is one state. So the only struggle is now, what kind of one state will it be? And to conclude this, I know those things sound right now not very realistic, but I can tell you one thing, that if we all of us would have met in the late 80s, and I would have told you in the late 80s, listen, within months, apartheid system is going to fall, Soviet Russia, big Soviet Russia is going to fall, and the Berlin Wall is going to fall, I can assure you, you would have never invited me to lecture here again. Because you would have been totally convinced that I'm out of my mind. Nobody had foreseen all those things. Nobody. And it happened. So many times things in history happen in an unexpected way, in an unexpected timing. I was enjoying Connecticut in the recent days, and I went every day with my partner, Patrick, for a walk in the morning through the woods, and I saw all those beautiful, beautiful trees, part of them lying on the ground. Strong, beautiful trees lying on the ground. Many times it happens. And you ask yourself, how come there's such a strong tree fall down? And then you look inside and you see it was totally rotten or hollow from inside. And I don't think that anyone can think here about something which is more rotten than the Israeli occupation. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Israeli journalist Gideon Levy speaking at Brandeis University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Or if you wish to hear the program later in the day or within a two-week period via the WZBC archive, simply access the WZBC homepage and click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. If you miss a program on the WZBC archive, remember it is only on that archive for 2 weeks. You can find any of our past broadcasts on our permanent archive, meticulously maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. To reach our permanent archive, to hear any past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. All the past broadcasts are on truthandjusticeradio.org. Archive. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us next week, next Sunday, when we will feature the voices of Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada and journalist Max Blumenthal. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.